Okay, that's what we're expecting. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and call the meeting? It's 8:30. Meeting order. If everybody can mute their phones, we're getting some feedback, so it would be helpful unless you want to speak and then unmute at that point in time. But we are going to first conduct the required public meeting. We're required to have two public meetings a year under Section 3.01 of the Act, Revised Civil Status. The first part of today will be the first public meeting. Our first, can somebody mute their phone? We're getting feedback, or somebody's got hearing noise there. Okay, the first order of business really is any public comment. John, if you could, anybody wants to talk, it's 5-star, I believe.
Correct, on your phone. We've got 4 in the public.
4 that want to speak?
No, just 4 members, and I don't see any with their hands raised.
Okay. Let's move on, and our second order of business then is to report on the health and performance of the system with the quarterly financial report and contribution reports. Brenda, our CFO, will lead us off with the report on the quarterly financials. So, Brenda, can you go ahead?
Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everyone. I want to start the first quarter financial review with the bridge chart. The bridge chart represents the changes in net position over the period by adjusting for investment, benefit, and operations-related transactions during the period to arrive at the ending net position. We began the year with a net position of $2.012 billion. We had investment-related transactions in 2021, which increased the net position by $34.46 million, and benefits and operations-related transactions decreased the net position by $26.91 million. And the March 31st net position is $2.02 billion, and that's up $7.5 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I want to briefly discuss some highlights from the financials. John, will you turn the page? The combined statement of fiduciary net position is next item I will review. This report compares the results from March 31st, 2021 to the preliminary results from December 31st, 2020. The first section is investment. Total investment value at the end of the first quarter was $1.921 billion, and that compares to $1.909 billion at the end of last year, 12/31. That's an increase of almost $12 million. The two largest components of the change were equity securities and real assets. Equity securities increased by $55 million during the quarter. In March of this year, the passive global equity mandate was funded with Northern Trust, and redemptions from Boston Partners, Manulife, Walter Scott, and Invesco, along with some additional cash, were used to fund the Northern Trust account. In real assets, they declined by almost $39 million during the quarter. We had distributions from AEW of $25 million for the sale of the Camel Square self-storage and Hearthstone of $15 million for the sale of Spring Valley, along with a distribution from JP Morgan Maritime of $1.8 million And then during the quarter, we also had several valuation changes from some of the properties. As we move down the report to the receivable section, and we look at the city and member receivables, contribution receivables, the increase during this first quarter is primarily related to the number of days accrued at the end of the month and an increase in the per day average payroll. So at the end of March, we accrued 15 days, and at the end of December, we only accrued 9 days. As we continue on down the schedule and look at cash, cash increased by $4.8 million during the quarter, and this increase is related to distributions from the sale of property during the quarter that were not redeployed into investments or used for operations. And as we near the bottom of the schedule and we see accounts payable and other accrued liabilities, they declined by $763,000 during the quarter. The decrease was primarily led by a decline in the fund management fee accrual of $571,000. There were also declines in refunds payable and accounts payable, and these were partially offset by increases in the uncompensated absences accrual for staff, as well as accrued liabilities. Next, I want to look at the changes in fiduciary position. John, would you turn the page? The changes in fiduciary net position in the fiduciary net position statement compare the results from March 31st of 2021 to the results from March 31st of 2020. And the first section is contributions. City contributions increased by $580,000 year over year. And this increase in city contributions is due to the increase in the floor. Last year, the floor was $5.7 million per pay period. And this year, it's almost $5.9 million per pay period. So the total increase due to the floor was a little over $1 million, and that increase was partially offset by accrual changes. As we look at member contributions, overall, member contributions increased by $551,000 year over year. Regular member contributions increased by $829,000. However, a decline in the drop contributions of $134,000 and accrual changes partially offset this increase. Employee headcount has declined by 164 when compared to March of last year. As we continue to move down the schedule and we look at net investment income, net investment income was up by almost $189 million year over year. The net appreciation depreciation increased by almost $191 million, and this increase was primarily driven by changes in equity, which was up $157 million. As we look at interest and dividends, they're down $1.1 million year over year, and that decline is primarily related to real asset income, which is down $1 million from last year. As we move down the schedule and we look at benefits paid to members increased by almost $783,000 a year over year. Service pensions increased by $964,000, and this increase was partially offset by declines in survivor benefits and disability payments, when compared to last year. And new service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. As we continue down the schedule and we look at legal expense has an overall credit for the quarter due to an insurance reimbursement. And without the reimbursement, legal expenses were $6,000 for the quarter. Staff expenses have increased year over year by almost $40,000. And that's due to staff vacation being earned and accrued but not taken, salary increases, and benefit expense increase.
Can I interrupt real quick? This is Gilbert. Yes. What was that insurance amount? And are we at our max already, or do we still have plenty more room on the legal expense?
So the insurance reimbursement that we received was for legal fees, and it was $469,000.
Is there a cap on it or anything like that, and are we close to it?
Josh, you want to talk about that? It's which cases it's related to, and are we expecting any more reimbursements?
Yeah, that relates to the Eddington and Deegan cases, and those cases are both over, so we're not expecting any more reimbursements. I mean, we have $50 million of fiduciary insurance, so we're well below any type of cap for any further claims or anything like that. So we're fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Last item is professional and administrative expenses. They've increased $67,000 year over year. We have increases in legislative consultants. That's up about $16,000. Because the legislature is currently in session. Also, smaller increases in risk insurance and communication, maintenance, IT items like pension admin software and licenses, security monitoring. Those items were partially offset by declines in employment expense and security expense. Are there any questions?
Okay, I guess not.
There's one final chart. John, if you'll turn the page, and we'll look at the net benefit shortfall chart. This chart graphically represents the shortfall between benefit contributions and benefit payments. So benefit payments in the last quarter were $81 million. And benefit contributions were $55 million. The average monthly shortfall in the first quarter was $8.6 million. And there is one note that I want to make as we look at this chart. This chart includes only benefit and contribution transactions and does not include any cash inflow or outflow related to this. Are there any questions about the net benefit shortfall chart? If not, I'll hand it back to you, Bill.
Okay. Actually, Kelly is going to go through the contribution report, so I'll let her do that next.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Before I start on the contribution report, I just wanted to say for anybody that's listening in the audience that isn't aware of this. Bill mentioned that we are required by the statute to do these meetings twice a year, and the requirement is we talk about the health and the performance of the pension system, and that's why you see that we're talking about the financial statements and the contributions that are coming in, because, you know, those directly affect the health and performance of the pension system. We will also, when we do the second required meeting of the year, talk about the funding level of the plan when we get the actuarial report. That only changes once a year, so that's why we're not talking about the funding status of the plan, because it hasn't changed officially since the last valuation. So that's, if anybody's wondering that's listening, you know, why are we talking about these two items under this meeting, and it's really because of the way the statute's written. So moving on to the contribution report, this is the May report, which includes the March 2021 data. There are two pay periods in this reporting period. This one of the things we're seeing, and you'll see this when you're looking at, well, the board will see this when they're looking at the consent agenda, is we are seeing a spike in retirements, which is not unexpected. There was a hiring surge about 30 years ago, so we have expected that approximately double the normal amount of employees, especially in the police department, will hit their 90% maximum. So they'll either join, drop at that point, or leave the system. And we're starting to see that increase in employee retirements, especially in the police department, as you'll see in your consent agenda. John, on page 8, you can see the contributions amount for the month. As I said, we have two pay periods this month. Based on actual comp pay, we received $11.4 million in contributions, which is approximately $400,000 less than the floor. So we're at 105% of the hiring plan estimate and 97% based on the floor. The reason that the contributions are showing as well as they are, even though the actual number of employees are down 159 or almost 3% of the total projected employees, is because the city did pretty significant raises in their meet and confer agreement. So although they don't have the number of people, the pay is up, but we'll continue to monitor, and hopefully they are hiring as fast as people are retiring, because, you know, they're well aware of this trend also. Since the bill has been in place, we have received 101% of the hiring plan estimate and 92% of the floor. So the floor has contributed $39.9 million to the plan since that time. Are there any questions about the contribution plan? Things haven't really changed. It is just a position of, we'll see how the timing works with the retirements versus the hiring. I think that's the biggest risk going forward.
Okay, thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Don't have anything else on the public meeting, so I will move that we adjourn the public meeting and go to the regular meeting. Does somebody want to second that motion?
I'll second, Bill. It's Gilbert.
Thank you, Gilbert. Does anybody oppose adjourning the public meeting at this point? Okay, it carries. Then we will reconvene the regular meeting at this point in time, and let's go to I've got to get back to my on the thing here.
It's on page 17.
Okay, I've got on my computer. Do we have the chart with the members who have passed away in the last month? That's what I want to get to for our moment of silence.
Yes, that's what's on 17. And John has it up on the Zoom.
Okay, it's now up there. Okay, that's good. Okay, why don't we take a moment of silence for these deceased police and fire officers for the month of April. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Okay, next will be the consent agenda. I'm just getting it. It starts on, I think, we page 18. Oh, no. We're showing the approval of minutes first. Those everybody has seen these in advance, but is there any comments or corrections to the minutes from our April 8th meeting? If not, can we get a motion to approve?
So moved, Alan.
Okay, thanks, Alan. I'll second that. Anybody opposed? Okay, that is approved. We now go on to the special meeting that was held on April 20th. Do you have that up there now, John? That's okay. Again, everybody has seen that. A relatively short meeting. Get a motion. Somebody want a motion approval of those minutes?
Yeah, this is Kent. I'll move.
Thanks, Kent.
Alan, second.
Anybody opposed? Okay, that approves that. Then we move on to the detailed consent agenda. And as Kelly noted, there are a lot more retirements here. But is there anything else unusual in the consent agenda that you want to bring to our attention, Kelly?
No, Bill, thank you.
Okay. So I'm just focusing here on, why don't we just scroll to the page with the retirees so everybody can see what they are. Can you show that, John?
We can't show that in the public, so you'll have to scroll in your PDF. We can't disclose that information.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Kelly. Okay. Being nothing else unusual, but there is a long list of names here on this. Can we get a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Armando.
Armando, thank you. Second. Tina, thank you, Tina. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
I guess we should probably go the reverse way again. That's easier. Does anybody oppose? Hearing none, we will say they're unanimously approved. And then we next go to, again, to the public comment, five-star. If anybody that's from the public is listening in, they wants to address the board, hit five-star, and we'll allow you to come in at this time.
I do have at least one. I'm going to unmute them now.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, go ahead. Can you identify yourself and let us know who you're speaking?
My name is Bourbon Smith, 31-year officer with the Dallas Police Department, Northeast Division.
Thank you.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
All right. First of all, I want to say thank you, Kelly. I was here last month, as you know. I'll be here every month going forward that I can. I want to thank Kelly first for always responding to our emails on my email. May not always like what she tells me, but she at least has the gall and the nerve to respond and give us an answer. And I just want to say we appreciate that. It doesn't go without us understanding it and thanking you for that, Kelly. Moving on to my comments, I still haven't heard back from our representative, Ken Haven. I see he's on the meeting again, but we still cannot get this man to come to us at Northeast or any division and speak with us in person. You know, this man needs to resign. I mean, we just got to have representation. You guys talked about people retiring over the last, for this 30-year period that you were anticipating. Some guys are just mad because they don't trust the pension system because they're not getting any information. I don't understand that. I mean, if you, those of you who want to get a COVID shot could have gotten a COVID shot. I've sent some of you emails about locations. The Northeast Division is sponsoring and partnering with Dallas County Health Human Services to get COVID vaccinations. So that excuse is out of the window as far as not having to come to these stations and meet with us. I've said this before. Everyone's offering us everything in the world at this station as far as fidelity, carpet, phones, et cetera. They can come in our station and talk to us and answer questions. But a pension board and its trustees can't come and talk to us. When do you guys plan on having regular meetings again? When will this stop? Anybody care to answer that for us?
Just hang on for the next item on our agenda is a discussion of that. So you'll get that answer less than 5 minutes.
That's great. Let me ask you this here. If this was a company, I mean, if this was a company that some of you are in private equity or private business, and this is what was going on in your corporation or company, would this be an acceptable practice not to talk to the members about what the financial status is? This is really bad, folks, and we just need a whole clean slate of people on these boards that had nothing to do with the downfall that we faced 7 or 8 years ago. And these young officers have no clue about the pension or how it works or what's in it for them. To me, that is just crucial that the members are educated. Some of you guys are, I just wonder, some of you are appointed by the mayor, I ask, are you there for resume building? I mean, you got to have some conscience about wanting to do right by the people of the city of Dallas. We're sick of the, we support police, thank you for your service. That gets old when it really comes down, when the rubber meets the road, no one's really looking out for us at all. I thank Armando, again, for what he's done. What is the plan to actually start coming and meeting with us, Mr. Haben?
Okay, Kelly, if you could get back with us and with Mr. Smith here, Brevin Smith, to let him know what plans are as we go forward for educating employees, that would be very helpful.
Let me ask you a question. Can Mr. Haben talk? My representative, can he talk to us?
Well, may I talk to you, sir? This is Alan Vaught. I'm a trustee.
You can talk to me, but I really would like to even hear Mr. Haben's voice to say something to us.
Yes, sir, but I want to talk because it's important for me to convey to you that, and I do think I speak for everyone, including Mr. Haben, that we care very much about our police and fire. Just about a month ago, I went along with Kelly and Josh to Austin, and I paid for it on my own dime. I did not even seek reimbursement for my travel, for my lodging, to fight a bill that would have been devastating for this fund. I do not get paid any money for my time on this board. I do it purely as public service. I'm a mayoral appointee. In my private practice, I'm an employment attorney, okay? So I want you to know that, you know, and again, I think I speak for the rest of the board. I'm not here to try to better myself because being on this board doesn't better my position. I'm here to try to help the men and women, the city of Dallas, to step forward and put their lives on the line. That's what I'm here for, and I think that's what the rest of the members are here for. And I will be happy to come and visit with you or your office, or your fellow officers at times in the future where we could coordinate it. I just want to be clear that, you know, that's something that I'm willing to do, and I think other board members are too. I just want to convey that to you.
Well, man, I really appreciate you saying that. I really appreciate you saying that you would come out and speak with us. I can give you my phone number. Kelly has my email information, contact information. Tell us when can you come. But as far as bettering yourself, I understand. I understand that. But we want to be better ourselves and be better educated and have someone come out and talk to us and just answer simple, mundane questions. I mean, we're just sick and tired of thank you for your service. But we're not getting anything in return. We put our lives on the line, man. This is the worst time to be a police officer in the United States, man. And I can't get my board people to come out here and talk to us. Do you see the frustration in my voice? I mean,
we're
sick of it. Is Ken Haben going to even say hello? Are you there, Ken? This is ridiculous, guys. You got to hold your folks that's with you accountable.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll appreciate that, but I'd echo what Alan said, is that for all the mayoral appointees and even those elected by the associations are doing this as a service. They're not doing it to do resume building. They're taking time away from their everyday activities, and it's been a hard time, but Kelly has been responsive, and Alan has agreed to do that, so I'm going to ask Kelly to coordinate that kind of a discussion and meeting.
Well, I'm saying, let me ask you, what is the purpose of...
Excuse me. This is Mark Malvo. I'm available, too. I've been serving on this board for over a year. I'm actually working. This is the day I would otherwise be working. And we spend hours a day, hours working on this project to try to make sure that this pension is as healthy as possible. And we've come a long way with it, and it's through the efforts of staff and the board to get that done on behalf of the firefighters and police officers. So I'm available also.
That is awesome to hear. And I know you can't speak for Mr. Haben, but are you available, Mr. Haben? That's a question. It's not sarcasm. Are you available, sir? But okay. He was fine.
I'll work on coordinating something. I mean, this is not supposed to be a time for back and forth, but
it's a simple question I've asked, and I deserve an answer to that.
We'll get back to you with an answer. We're not required to answer. We're here to listen to your comments, and we will respond to them as appropriately. Thank you.
I got other comments then. For your rules, I still have time to talk if you just want to hear my comments. Another comment is, if you guys are getting all this great information, which I know you have it within your board and the trustees, mayoral appointees, and you're not sharing with us, what good is it? We have all this information. We're working hard for you. I believe you are, but how about sharing that information with the members, the folks who are going out working every day?
What information are you referring to? I mean, these are public meetings. We've gone through the financials. We go through.
Bill, this is Mark. Everything we do is public. There's nothing other than when we're dealing with litigation that is not public. All financial information and decisions that we are made are on our website. Every financial decision, investments, and in terms of income producing costs are all there. So there's nothing that is not completely available online and is posted. So what are you looking for?
We want to be able to have you come in and answer simple questions that the officers, especially the new officers who don't know much about the pension, so they can ask questions that may be seem mundane or dumb to you, but it gives them some insight about the pension. To talk about the well-being, how well it's doing, et cetera. Y'all can talk all these percentages and all that sounds great. You guys are in that world. You understand that, but a lot of the everyday officer does not, and he wants to be able to ask you those questions in person, face-to-face. And you get that. I know you do.
Yeah, no,
It's Armando.
Here with the pandemic and all, but Kelly is going to be developing an education plan and to provide basic information. So please give us a chance to do that. Things are just starting to open up now, and hopefully we'll get this done here in the next several months.
And I want to offer olive leaf to you guys. If anyone's still waiting to get a COVID vaccination, and that's the reason you're not coming to meet with us in person, I have a list of about 10 sites that I'll be glad to forward to you like I did in the email a couple of weeks ago. Even provide transportation on my own time, own dime to get you there. That is that important to us.
Hey, Bourbon, it's Armando.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Armando.
Hey, so let me work on this. Let me take this action item. I know exactly what you're saying. Our members, our police officers and firefighters don't want to hear 100% funding, this and that.
Exactly.
They want it in layman's terms. And let me work with the staff to see what we can develop and get it out there to you guys, to you men and women. I'm sitting here listening to your points. You have some good points. And it's not the they want the meat and potatoes. They don't want the granular stuff right now.
Exactly.
And we need to package it in a way that our police officers and firefighters can understand it. And then we have to have the people that can deliver it in those terms. And so please give me an opportunity to work with the staff to develop that and come up with a plan to communicate that to our members. Okay?
And I appreciate it. It's the same thing. I once spoke with Kelly, and I told her I wouldn't be messing with her, emailing her, et cetera, give her time to get the plan. I know she's been in litigation the last month, and I get that. We're not dumb. None of the people behind me here are dumb. We're just asking for information. And I think we it's owed to us that our representative communicates with us. I mean, I know you guys are smart and have a lot of common sense. Is this not insane that we can't get our representative even to talk on this conference call to respond?
Your point is well made. We'll be responsive. Kelly and Armando have agreed to take this on and work with you to get it communicated in a way you can. So,
what about our representative? Shouldn't he be involved? Shouldn't he be raising his hand and say, "I also want to be part of this"? I'm not going away, guys. I'm not going away.
This is Josh. Okay. I think we've had enough back and forth. I think at this point, so Bill.
Pardon me?
But you know, if I do this, I have to do this every month and take your time up, I will. It's just that important to the younger officers. And if you're here to help us, like you say, we support our police and fire. Stand up for us today, guys. Stand up for us and do what you say you're going to do, that you're here to help. And I had the two speeches two guys gave me about they're not getting paid for this. I understand that. But at the same time, be willing to do the work that helps us understand what's going on, so that we don't have what happened to us 7 or 8 years ago by us not understanding and not asking questions. You should applaud me for wanting to ask questions, because that's what got us in the position. We shook our heads and said yes, yes, yes to all these former board members. We need a clean slate, guys. We need a clean slate of people representing us that had nothing to do with the last fiasco.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your time is up. We really need to move on. So is there anybody else, John, that's raised their hand?
No,
John?
I don't see anything.
Okay, let's move on then to item C3, which is the discussion on in-person board meetings. Basically, the feedback we got in the last month were twofold, really. There were two trustees who have not been vaccinated and are unlikely to be vaccinated in the near term. And number two, there were a number of board members who prefer that we hold off having in-person meetings till July. So that would probably be the plan now, but I'd like to get any other feedback. My thought is, I mean, we do need to know if any board members who have been vaccinated have a problem with other board members being unvaccinated attending either, and whether or not the appropriate way to attend would be either with masks at the meeting and or on a Zoom call. But I'd like to get any feedback from anybody else at this point in time. Otherwise, that would be the plan to start meeting in July.
Hey, Bill, this is Gilbert. As one who travels, that's fine with me. I'm vaccinated, and if people are not, that's okay with me as well. You know, we can sort of distance those around or something like that. The planes, you know, they're packed again. People wear masks. The planes take a lot of great care. So I'm happy to go in person in July.
Okay, thank you.
This is Alan. I agree with that. I've been vaccinated. However, I still wear a mask when I'm in public. I don't care what other people in the room do, but I'll be wearing my mask. And, you know, I treat it as though I've not been vaccinated, even though I have. But I'm fine with that approach as well.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else that either wants to comment as to being okay or not okay with that?
Hey, Bill.
This is Steve.
Plan.
I'm good with it.
Hey, okay. Bill, it's Armando. I support the plan. I have one question in regards to the legislation that was passed in 2017, and there's some rules around how many people or how many meetings a person can either miss, or is there something in there about how many a person can attend via teleconference? And if so, this question is for Josh. Is there a way that we can work around that to make everybody comfortable?
No, attending by teleconference is the same as attending in person, so that all counts as being in attendance, so that's not a problem.
Perfect. Thank you.
So just to clarify, Bill, it's beginning in July, the trustees will be present if they want to be, but Zoom would still be an option if, for some reason, they're traveling or don't feel comfortable, but the public would still be on Zoom. Is that the intention?
I believe so, yeah. That's what I would suggest. Okay.
This is Mark. I'm sorry. And I kind of, Kelly, I appreciate you making that distinction. Unfortunately, I'd assume that the meetings would be the public could attend. Is there, and I'm someone who really wants to comply with whatever the experts are saying, particularly the CDC, is the reason that we would not allow the public to attend the meetings, is that more also of a COVID precaution?
Yes.
Yes, it's a space issue.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks, Mark. Our next agenda item is a report from the Audit Committee. Armando, Tina, and myself serve on that committee. We met on Zoom on April 28th with our auditors. Basically, it was a planning meeting, just a discussion of the upcoming audit. A couple of the key points made were basically that the staff is pretty much, the continuity is the same, and we've got the same partner, managers, senior staff doing the audit, which will make it a much more consistent audit, as well as a much more efficient audit, as we saw when we approved the contracts for them, that their fees are going to be lower partially. That is using some of the Indian affiliates' offshore activities for sort of the ticking and checking, but none of the personnel information that we provide would be going over there. The other two major areas we discussed was the valuations, particularly of our private equity portfolios. Again, they have the same guy who's looked at them in the last several years, and they've got a consistent methodology which they would utilize as we go through that. And then lastly, we talked about their taking a look at just cybersecurity issues to make sure that we've got reasonable controls in place to avoid any major issue. I believe those were the key points, but Tina or Armando, do you want to add anything to that?
No, that was pretty much it. We spent a good amount of time talking about, outsourcing overseas and the cybersecurity. But, yeah, that was a good synopsis.
Okay. Armando, do you want to add anything? Or?
No, that was a really good summary and recap.
Okay, thank you. Okay, then we shall move on to a legislative update from Josh on what's going on down in Austin.
Thanks. Thanks, Bill. So the two bills that we are involved with, HB 3375, that's Representative Davis's bill, we had the special meeting on. And I think we've reached language that Kelly and I have approved that went through the Pensions Committee. And checking this morning, it appears that that bill is set for the local consent calendar on Friday. So likely it goes through. To my knowledge, there's no opposition to it. HB 4068, the bill that we had pushed with respect to giving the board the ability to put the staff in the TMRS pension plan, did pass the House this week, and it's on to the Senate. And I guess my general take is that that bill is also unopposed, so I think it's probably in no guarantees of anything with respect to the legislature, but it's probably more likely than not that both bills will make it through the Senate and I would guess get signed by the governor. I would assume Representative Davis is going to pursue her bill in the Senate and find a sponsor. And we're trying to do the same on the Senate side with Hilco's assistance. So those are the two primary bills. There's no other bills that right now that appear to have gotten through to pass the House or the Senate that would directly affect at this point, DPFP. And if there's any questions.
Hey, Josh, this is Ken. I've got a question, but it's more on the federal level. On the Secure Act 2.0, what I understand, it's come out of the House Ways and Means Committee for a vote, and I think the only thing that may affect us on that would be the required minimum distribution age is going to be raised again. Is that any kind of a problem on our end for the retirees since it's been annuitized on the drop end? How much extra do we pay out on required minimum distributions at 72 now? And would it going, it's supposed to go to 75, would that help us any?
No, there's actually, now that all the drop accounts have been annuitized and will be annuitized in the future, there's no required minimum distribution applicable. So I think, thankfully, okay, because that was a very difficult calculation, that's not something that's part of what we do anymore. So no, there's no effect on us.
All right. Okay, good. The bill seemed to be more leaning toward deferred comp than it was us, but I just wanted to make sure that the RMDs wouldn't be a problem for us.
Correct.
Any further questions? Okay, hearing none. Kelly, were you going to report on meetings, conferences, seminars, et cetera?
Yes, that information is on page 45 of your packet. There are no new conferences listed here, so unless somebody wants to add their name to a conference, we don't need a motion here.
What is the cost on the TechSpurs conference?
That's a good question. I don't know. It says TBD. It's usually pretty inexpensive. I'm thinking $400 sticks in my mind, but we can look that up and I'll let you know by the end of the meeting what that cost is. It's generally pretty inexpensive.
I think the cost is just the tuition part of it is $25 for members, which we're a member of.
Oh, okay. So I must be thinking of the travel, the hotel.
The hotel and travel adds up. And then, of course, and CEPRS, their tuition is a lot higher than $25. But for TechSpurs, just for the cost to attend the conference, tuition-wise, is just $25.
Okay. That is quite inexpensive. Okay. Okay, next we're going to cover a report from the Investment Advisory Committee. Gilbert or Ryan, do you want to report?
Yeah. Ryan, I'll let you take it. But everything was in order. So, Ryan, you go ahead.
Okay, before we get into it, Gilbert, I just wanted to start by saying how excited I am, and I can speak for the team, Greg and Mike, to be working with you guys during this transition period and beyond. We have a relatively full and important investment agenda today with the asset allocation review and recommendation. Hancock is going to review the ag portfolio, but we'll start with the ISE recap and then move into portfolio update. If there's any part of today's agenda you guys want to spend more time on or just do a deep dive on part of the portfolio, feel free to reach out to me directly. Be happy to sit down with you guys.
Good point is that, you know, I reviewed the asset allocation review and it makes some sense, but I do think this is one of the important decisions a board makes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mentioned to Kelly and Ryan that, you know, to try to just thoroughly approve it today may be a little quick. We may want to reflect on it a little longer and make suggestions and then, you know, vote on it later. So we're not necessarily going to be looking to approve this today. In likelihood, I think it's prudent to hold it off a month at the final approval, but I think we'd like to really give some final direction staff on it. I'm on the National Railroad Board, and we go through a similar process, and that takes us part of a year to get through three or four meetings discussions. Now, there is a lot more liquidity and a lot more assets there, but I think at least having a two-month period of time is probably going to make sense.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, it's been an iterative process with us and Makita and then to the IAC. So if we need another iteration or two, that's fine. So IAC met on April 20th. It was a special meeting to review asset allocation. We took four potential mixes to IAC for review and got good feedback and kind of led us to the recommendation we're at today. And then we also reviewed the U.S. small cap RFP process. We're just issued the RFP a couple weeks ago, and we got seven responses in last Friday, so we're getting into review of those RFPs with the plan to bring finalists back to the IAC in June and potentially recommendation to the board in July. Anything else you want to add on IAC, Gilbert?
No, let's fire away.
Okay, good deal. All right, moving into a portfolio update on slide 48, John. So I added a few new charts and slides into the portfolio update. I'll review kind of what's new and what we're talking about here. John, a chance to catch up here. First chart is on 49. This is a bar chart looking at asset allocation versus target using the adjusted private market NAV from 430. A few areas I wanted to point out here. First, EM debt. We're fully allocated across fixed income, essentially outside of EM debt, which is about halfway full. If you look to the left, you can see in global equity, we're at 37% of our 40% target. So we're within striking distance there. And then next to that in EM equity, this is by design based on the implementation plan from 2018, but we're significantly underweight to EM equity at 3.3% of the 10% target. I just think it's easier to see the allocation this way as opposed to the following chart on slide 50, which gets a little bit busy. If you can move ahead, John.
But, Ryan, I just would add, just for the benefit of the board, especially with new board members, when we did this, there was some concern about whether emerging market equity should be quite this high. It is an overrated, and I think we really sort of said as we go through the process before we fund it to this level, we would have more discussion on it, and that's what this allocation study is going to be reviewing, whether it is. I mean, the one concern is that we already have some equity in our global managers, and the normal benchmark weighting is more like 12% of equities. This is going to be about 20% of equities, I guess, or maybe a little less, 16. So I think that's something that needs a little discussion as we get to
the allocation presentation. Yep. We'll talk about EM a little bit more and how we plan to fund it up and the reasons it's in the allocation at such a high weighting.
Yep.
Okay, on 50, just a few things here. If you look at the bottom of the page, you can see the private market adjustment of $59 million, which is 8.7%. That's down from 15% last month based on removing the bulk of that AEW adjustment. We anticipate the audit coming in a matter of days now, and we had been adjusting that by 25%. We've removed that to lower it to the expected Q4 values that are coming in. So overall, we're adjusting from $2.0 to $3 billion down to $1.975 billion. At the top of the page in red, I've added detail on the global equity portfolio. It just seemed that for such a big part of the portfolio, you guys don't see how we're allocated across it on a monthly basis. So wanted to start showing the detail there. And we can start thinking about if we increase the allocation to public equity, global equity, how we should be allocating across our five managers and two new managers coming in the next year. If you look at Northern Trust, the passive account, you can see we're up to $183 million, which is a little bit above the target laid out in the global equity structure. That's by design, as we intend to use that overweight to fund the U.S. small cap and international small cap mandates as we get those hired and filled out. All right, moving on to slide 51. On investment activity, we've received $49 million in distributions year to date. We got another $3 million coming in today from the sale of FIA, the U.S. Timberland asset. I'm expecting about $25 million more in distributions from sales that are either under contract or in process by mid-July. On the end-of-life private equity funds, we're continuing daily to monitor those. We'll talk later today about Huff Energy and the plan there. And then, as I mentioned, on the IAC, we received seven responses on the U.S. small cap RFP last Friday.
Maybe next month you can tell who's actually responded or who you're considering.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the blackout list, the names of all seven are on there, but we can add to the portfolio update next month just who the seven are and if we've made any initial determinations on semifinalists, if you'd like.
Good. That would be helpful.
Okay.
And just to remind you, the blackout list is in diligent under the Resource Center, if you're looking for that.
Thank you, Kelly. All right, on slide 52, this is a new chart as well, table, whatever you want to call it. But we always go through the monthly calendar of board items. John, if you go ahead one slide. But we wanted to show our major investment initiatives through end of the year, what we're going to be working on. Many of these are coming out of the asset allocation review today, but expected me to come back in June potentially to finalize the asset allocation, update the IPS for the updated allocation, targets and ranges, implementation, and then to discuss actuarial rate of return. Was there a question or? Okay, Q3, expecting to have that U.S. small cap recommendation to the board, plan to launch the international small cap search in Q3, and then do asset class reviews of EM and global equity. And in Q4, potentially the recommendation for higher on the international small cap mandate, and then depending on where we go with EM and the structure there, likely need to add another manager in addition to RBC to fill out that allocation. So launching a search there. All right, on 53, looking at the board calendar, they mentioned Hancock's going to be in today to talk about the ag portfolio. Moving forward through the summer, we're going to move into the infrastructure reviews, then on to private equity and debt, and then we'll cover the public part of the portfolio in September and October. All right, any questions before we move into asset allocation? Okay. All right, we're on slide 54 now, John. So the asset allocation presentation is kind of broken up into three parts. I'm going to provide an overview of the process and big themes I want to be thinking about and a summary of the recommendation. Then Makita is going to provide more detail on the cash outflow situation, scenario analysis, and the recommendation, and then I'll come back to discuss implementation and next steps. So I wanted to start off by highlighting major themes that we've been thinking about throughout this process in coming up with the recommendation. First, we still have a very high magnitude of cash outflows for benefit payments, $9 million a month, or $108 million per year, which is 6% of the plan goes out the door every year. And actuaries expecting this to gradually increase over the next 5 years. Given that cash outflow situation, the path of investment returns matter. So if we go into a lower return environment in the near term, we're going to be in worse shape than a plan that did not have the cash outflow magnitude that we have. Makita will provide more detail on how that works out and the impacts of that. So the safety reserve is definitely still needed given the high level of cash outflows. The discussion we've been having is given the drag on investment returns of having 15% in cash and short-term core bonds, what is the appropriate level to reduce it to? And lastly, we still have a high allocation to illiquid private market assets, including the riskier legacy assets. And wherever we set the long-term targets, we're not going to reach them for 2+ years. We're at just over 30% private markets right now. So until we get down to that 15% level, we won't be fully allocated across the liquid asset classes. All right, on 57, I have the allocation timeline for 2021. Really kicked off when Makita updated their 2020 return study in February. If you guys remember, in March, Makita was in and did a preliminary asset allocation presentation and review at the March board meeting. As I mentioned, at the IAC in April, we reviewed four possible mixes and got good feedback on those mixes and kind of helped us get to the recommendation today. And then, as I mentioned, in June, we'll need to follow up to either finalize this or finalize IPS for implementation in the changes to the long-term allocation. So, John, if you can move to 59 now. So I'm just going to provide a summary of what the changes, recommended changes are, and then hand it over to Makita. But staff and Makita are jointly recommending the following changes that are approved or supported by the IAC. First, it would be a 6% reduction in short-term investment-grade bonds, the portfolio managed by IRM, from 12% down to 6%, which would lower the safety reserve from 15% down to 9%. Then if you look down to global bonds, we have currently have a 4% target allocation there. You guys remember we liquidated the Brandywine account last year and decided to hold off on officially eliminating the allocation until we got into the asset allocation study this year. So we'd be officially lowering that down to zero. And then that 6% and that 4% would be added to global equity, increasing the target there from 40% to 50%. Slide 60 just shows it on bar chart where we're allocated now versus current target and potential new target. So before I hand it off to Makita, any initial questions on what I've covered so far?
I guess the other question I have, and we've talked about, Ryan, is the emerging market equity at 10%, in addition to a roughly 4% that's in global equities, or is that would you be reducing the standalone by whatever we have in global equities on average over a period of time?
So it would be in addition to whatever exposure to EM is within the global equity portfolio. Our four active managers have a pretty significant underweight to EM in their portfolios. On a look-through basis, if we were fully allocated 50% to global equity and 10% dedicated to EM, our overall EM exposure of equity would be about 20% as compared to a market weight of 12. So it's the 10% dedicated plus the exposure in the four active managers. The two small cap mandates would have no EM, and then the Northern Trust product has a market weight to EM. So that's kind of how we get to the math on that.
That results in a significant overweight to EM then.
Yeah, I mean, it's 19% versus 12.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about the safety reserve reduction?
Yeah, let me go to that if I could. Let me go to that, Ryan. This is Gilbert. So, Tina, the key was, you might recall, when you and I and some of the others first came in, we put the safety reserve there, and at that time there was significant uncertainty about cash flow, about markets, about a lot of these illiquid assets. Since that time, you know, there's a lot more known information. A lot of the illiquid assets have paid off some, et cetera. And so we think now's a good time to start moving some of that money into higher yielding asset classes. And so we just don't think it's as necessary to have such a high safety reserve like we did at the beginning. At the beginning, it made sense because we were in uncharted territory. We had just had, you know, big withdrawals. We just didn't know where we were. But now it's behind us, a lot of it. And so it's really a function of putting that money to work. And
okay,
I think Makita will probably talk a little bit. Makita will talk a little bit more about it because they'll have some of the math behind it.
Okay,
yeah,
because
we have
I just wanted to kind of revisit that as well, because I believe that the 15% also represented like maybe 2.5 years out of coverage. So I just want to talk more. I'm sure Makita will talk more about that later. The other thing I want to also kind of just reiterate on the previous slide is that, do we really just have only 30% of legacy illiquid real estate assets in the portfolio? Just 30%?
Yeah, I mean, we're at 32% right now. Yeah, legacy is, I think, about half of that, maybe a little bit more than half. But we've had quite a few real estate sales this year, and then, you know, write-downs in private equity and some of the troubled assets have kind of lowered the allocation.
Have we caught up, Ryan, have we caught up on that schedule for moving over some of these illiquid to the liquid side of the equation? Or
we were caught up in Q1, but I mean, 2020 put us way behind what we, you know, We're not okay. where we expected to be 3 years ago, but we're on pace this year.
Okay.
Over time, our expectations of amounts coming back per quarter have been lowered based on the actual results we've seen and some of the difficulties on some of the legacy assets, and then we've had next to nothing in distributions last year.
And just generally speaking, it's just I'm just a tad bit more concerned when you even consider the volatility in the markets this year. Like having more exposure to the equity markets or the even global equity markets, and then just reducing the reserve. The reserve actually kind of helped us in some point in what was happening in 2020. You know what I mean? It's kind of like I'm just going to throw it out there. There is just a little concern.
No, it's understandable. And we have slides later on in the presentation on how we got comfortable with the reduction in safety reserve, you know, the risk of walking into more into equity after, you know, the returns we've seen in the last few years. So I want to give Makita a chance to go through the cash flow situation and talk about what we're actually seeing and what we expect to see on cash flows, and then we'll come back and really hammer some of those points you're talking about, Tina.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you what I see in other pension funds and other boards I'm on is historically fixed income was sort of anchored to windward to protect us. But given that yields are so low, somebody's typing or something, and inflationary expectations are starting to rise. We saw a 4% inflation year over year.
Yeah, I saw that.
Create negative returns in fixed income. So people are starting to say fixed income can't, given the current environment, isn't going to do what it has historically, and are shifting there to slightly higher equity allocations and lower fixed income allocations. So,
good question. Do we consider cash an asset?
Yes, it's part of the investment portfolio.
Okay, just curious. Thanks. But I do agree with you, Bill, too.
Yeah. Okay, look, that's why I think these changes, we need to think a little bit. But let's go ahead, Ryan. Keep moving on.
Okay, so Makita's going to take over, I guess, on slide 69 of Diligent.
69?
69. Leo, Aaron, you guys there?
I am here. Ryan and trustees, can you hear me well?
Yes.
Got you, Leo.
Great. So let's see what slide we're on. Okay, we're at the beginning of our section. So we've listened from the beginning of this meeting, so we already have the feedback from today as it relates to timing, as it relates to, you know, talking more about safety reserve, emerging markets. So the presentation is divided into a few areas. The first one, you know, it's the basics. So why are we doing this? Then we go into looking at the liability stream. We, you know, spend some time discussing these topics like, you know, size of safety reserve, emerging markets. And then we look at potential new policies, and we stress test those through different ways. So that's what we have in front of us today. And again, if you think about why this matters, well, it's the decision that likely has the greatest impact on future returns and distributions. And it is a key component of your investment policy statement. In fact, under Section 4, Item B, there's three sections on core beliefs about asset allocation. The first one being it has a greater effect on return variability than anything else. It is essential to account for liabilities. That's what we're doing, that. And then rebalancing, in other words, the implementation. And then on Item D, which we'll cover today as well, is that when you have cash flows, the sequence of returns, the path that the returns take, matter more than the average returns that you get. And so that's where we will go over those as well. So having said that, let's see. We're going to move on to, let's see what page to start. We can probably skip ahead to 78, to start looking at the asset liability study. So this is something similar to the work we did back in 2018. So the starting point is, you know, all of the information we get from the most recent actuarial study. Now, the issue is that, you know, it was not done right away. So it was done at some point in time in the past, about the middle of the year, as I recall, and at that time, returns were pretty weak. And so the assumption was, okay, maybe we will assume a 6% loss for 2020. It turned out to be a stronger year than that. And so that changes the starting point of the assets. And for that reason, if you look to the next page, which is page, let me see, 80, we have an adjusted baseline for the starting point, which essentially captures the better performance of 2020 and therefore the greater asset value of the fund at that point in time. This also accounts for the reservations and some valuations on your private assets. So it's the same adjusted NAV that you have seen from staff in past meetings and that Ryan went over today. So if we skip over to page 82, this is a key concept. Here what we are assuming...
John, can you go ahead to 82?
We are assuming the starting point with the market value of the fund as it exists today, and we assume that we're going to make that 7% year after year. And so you'll see that you grow to well over $7 billion if you didn't have any cash flows. And if you had a period when maybe you had strong returns early on, followed by weak returns, but that they nonetheless averaged to 7%, you end up in the same point. Conversely, if you have the starting period when returns are weak, but then you have, you know, a good rally at the end, on average, you still make 7%, you end up at the same point, $7.3 billion over 20 years.
Leo, hold on a second. John or Damien, yes, can you guys go to 82 on the Zoom? Thank you. Just want to make sure we're looking at the right page here, Leo.
Yeah. So that's 82. So if you recall that page and now you flip two more to 84, now you'll see the impact of the cash flows. So I'm going to wait until we get to 84 on the screen. That's 82, as I see it.
Can we move to 84?
Thank you. So on 84, now we have the exact same percentage returns. The only thing that changes is now we incorporate the cash flows as projected by the actuary over the next 20 years. What you see is now the base case essentially results in very similar asset levels. Why? Well, because the cash flows are very similar to the expected return over the next decade or two. If we have a period where we have strong returns early on, that helps us because that means the asset fund increases in size and then we compound on a larger pool of assets. Even though the percentage is the same, the dollar basis is affected when you include cash flows. Conversely, if we go through a tough period, think of 2007, 8, 9, early on, then when the recovery comes, we're at a much smaller pool of capital. And so we get the same percentage gains, but on dollar terms, they're much smaller. I think somebody wanted to say something. Okay. And so what happens is, you know, you run the risk of depleting the funds if you have a very strong, difficult, challenging market environment early on. So that's a key concept. You know, it's not just the average return. It's not just making that 7%. It's how we make that 7% that will have an impact at a fund when you have meaningful cash flows. And so if you were to advance just to the next page, we are going to look at those cash flows. So page 85. There we go. So on page 85, you'll see as projected by the actuary, the cash flows actually increase as a percentage of the fund. And we're assuming, again, the fund grows by the actuary assumed rate of return. And what you'll see is that bottom row in red, it shows the expected net cash flow as a percentage of the fund's market value grows from just under 7% to about 8%. Now, if we go through a period of underperformance because, you know, markets go against us, then that percentage will increase because the cash flows remain the same, but the asset value of the fund decreases. If you continue to move now to page 86, we have the same information graphically. And so what you see is we still have a couple of more years until we hit essentially the worst period in terms of the ratio of cash outflows to the value of the fund. And then it begins to recover, so that about a decade out, we are at about the same point as we are now, and then we expect that to continue to improve. So the most challenging time for the fund will be the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, when there is a greatest drain on capital to meet expected benefit payments. Now, again, these are projections. They may come sooner, they may come later, but this is what is being projected now. Now, the projections have been a bit more pessimistic than reality. Looking at the last couple of years, for example, the actuary has been projected about 10 million and growing to about 12. But the reality is, by looking at some of the charts you looked at earlier today, it's been between 8 to 9 million per year in projections. So we are assuming for this exercise the 9, but we have, you know, calculated what would be the impact if that increases by, you know, each $1 million per month increase, what is the impact on that. So, you know, it has some impact, but it is, you know, I think using 9 is very fine for the purposes of this exercise. I'm going to skip a page or two, and then I'm going to pause and take any questions on section 1, which is this, looking at this liability stream. And then I'm going to cover the next section, and then eventually Aaron will jump in. So let me just skip ahead to page 88, please. So we're going to do a scenario analysis here where we shock the returns in the short term, because that's what matters more, as we just covered. And so what we do is, instead of assuming the more average or expected 7% return, what if we do much better over the next 5 years and we were to make 14? Conversely, what if we just make 0? So in other words, we go 7 to 14 or 7 to 0, and we use those numbers because they're still realistic in the sense that we did experience periods in the past when the mixed portfolio of the stock and bonds generated returns above 14% for a 5-year period or below 0 for a 5-year period. So these are certainly more extremes, but not unprecedented. And what we find out is quite shocking. On the following page, page 89, great, we're there. On the page 89, everything is the same except for the first 5 years, where the returns differ, right? One is at 7, one is at 14, one is at 0 for those first 5 years. Then we have another 50 years of data. And look at the ending point. So the funded status can be 100%. It could get pretty close to 0, or it can recover kind of as projected and shown by the actuary. So just changing the returns over the next 5 years has a dramatic impact. So essentially what we're going to do next is zoom in over the long term and the short term and look at market values in addition to funding status. So on page 90, we look at the ending value over just, again, those changes on the first 5 years when you look at 55 out. And it's dramatic. In one case, you're over $50 billion. In another one, you're at about 25, and in another one, you're at about 12. So lots of changes just by looking at, you know, a couple of years different returns early on. And on the following page, on 91, we just focus a little bit on the short horizon, and you'll see that, you know, the fund can go below $1 billion if we were to get into a period of very weak returns and there are no adjustments made for that. So with that, I'm going to pause. I went fairly fast on this, but again, the material, most of the slides, you know, has a good amount of text so that if you read it, hopefully you can get the gist of each slide. But I'm going to pause and take any questions at this point before we move to incorporating into the analysis feedback from the IAC, board members, staff over, you know, the past few years through today.
Leo, can you show 93 first and just the impact on percentage of cash flows based on those return assumptions?
Yeah. So on 93, let me see if we're in it. We're in it, yeah. So on 93, what you see is, again, the same three examples, the base, the pessimistic, and the more optimistic. And what you see is that, as I mentioned earlier, without actually pointing to the page, cash flows can get to somewhere between 11 and 12% in a scenario where, you know, we make roughly nothing over the next few years. We know the dollar figure, and if we assume tough times ahead, then the market will decline. We pay benefits, you know, and so it grows from the, you know, 8.5% to, you know, potentially 11 to 12%. So because it's only for a few years and then there is a change, it's recoverable. But I've seen funds where the situation is so dire that if your negative cash flow position is too extreme, there is no way you can solve the viability or the ongoing concern of a pension scheme just with investments alone. In other words, there is no way to guarantee making 15% return investment year after year consistently. So at some point in time, investments alone cannot solve it. Now, in this case, you know, it seems like there is a turnaround and things improve after a few years, but we're just highlighting that, you know, in the perfect storm, it's going to be very challenging ahead. Hopefully, with any luck, we manage to navigate well, and that's what we're trying to protect by having some safety reserve, as we will discuss shortly, to ensure at least we don't have to sell assets in a depressed environment, furthering a weakening of the fund.
Thanks, Leo.
You're welcome. If there are no questions, I will continue in section two. If there are questions, I'll take those now.
And let's go through the next section, and then we can get all things together.
Perfect. So let's go now to page 95, please. All right, thank you. So the four key topics that I want to go over include the need and the size of the safety reserve, covering a little bit of the history and why we have it in the portfolio. And more quickly, I think we'll cover global bonds, because I think there's been a lot of consistency on that from just about everybody we have talked to. Emerging markets, through today, you know, it's, you know, an area where people have different viewpoints, so we will address, you know, options there. And then the last one is, well, what should we do about bonds in this low rate environment? So let's start with the first one, safety reserve. You will recall when we came in and before we even were retained, we discussed this idea of maybe it makes sense to essentially immunize or segregate cash to meet ongoing benefit payments and expenses that are known. And at the time, there were, as correctly pointed by Gilbert, a lot more uncertainty than there is today. The
Can you guys go to 96, please?
Sorry? I'm on the next page, page 96.
96. John, 96? Yep, you got it.
Yeah. So at the time, illiquid assets comprised over 50% of assets. Legacy assets comprised 26% of assets. There was a recently passed, you know, plan to, you know, hire employees. And at the time, you know, it took a while to get going. And so we were trying to figure out, okay, is it going to go, you know, along the lines of the Citi hiring plan or the actual projections make more sense? So there were a lot of uncertainties. Also, keep in mind at the time, yields on short-term bonds were somewhere between 2 and 3%. It hit, you know, pretty much between 0 and 1 over the time that it was implemented. So the cost of holding safety reserve to some degree increased in terms of the opportunity cost of those assets. So that's a bit of the history. But the premise was, okay, we have these assets segregated. We have full reassurance that no matter what happens, no matter how bad the environment, at this level, we have 2.5 years worth of protection, meaning no matter what happens, the rest of the portfolio, we don't need to even touch it. We can use this money to pay any benefits, any bills that come due, and we have good visibility into what those are. So to some degree, having these insurance, if you will, of some kind, allows the rest of the portfolio to potentially be invested more aggressively to offset partially or fully the lower return of this safety reserve. Now, in these 3 years or so, we went through two corrections in the market. The recovery was quite quick in both cases. We cannot infer if this will continue to be when the third drawdown comes into it, but perhaps there is something to be said that government, central banks, et cetera, will be quicker to implement. Now, we can't rely on that, but that could happen. But specific to the pension fund, there is increased clarity. So contribution rates have improved, employment figures have improved, legacy assets have gotten smaller, illiquid assets have gotten smaller, Ryan pointed those out. So what we're doing is evaluating a decrease in the safety reserve, and we look at two options, taking it to about 2 years' worth of coverage or 1.5 years' worth of coverage from the 2.5 that we have today. So the table on the next page, page 97, thank you, looks into that. So keep in mind that, again, you have to balance the dollar figure with the percentage, right? Because if you said targets, typically it's in the percentage basis, but the bills come to you in dollars and not in percentage. So if the denominator changes a lot, it creates issues and adjustments. If it doesn't change, then it's a non-issue. But if you look at dollar figures, we have, you know, roughly $300 million was the target for the original safety reserve. If you were to cut it to about 12%, then you have about $216 million. And if you were to look at Proposal B, which takes it to 1.5 years or 18 months of coverage, then we're talking about $160 million. Now, at the original target, we were budgeting $10 million per month on net cash outflows. This year, in the past 12 months, it's been somewhere between $8 and $9 million. We're using 9 now. And in the footnotes there, we show what would happen if it were to be 10 in reality. And so with the fund value of 1.87, that's what it turns out to be. Those are the amounts you need to have in your safety reserve to roughly offer 24 or 18 months worth of coverage. On the next slide, thank you, we look at the, some of the theory, and I kind of went over it, but the positive is you have this reassurance, then you can use this cash to pay bills when they can due, and that while that comes at a low return for that pool of money, it allows the rest of the portfolio to be invested more aggressively. And, you know, if you have too much of it, which at times of distress it can happen, because if you were at target and then the rest of the fund goes down, then that percentage goes up. That was what happened earlier in 2020, and so the excess was used to rebalance and buy equities at what turned out to be a very low point in time in March of 2020. Now, we're not recommending or advocating to be tactical with it, but if you have excess returns or excess allocations during a time when there is a drawdown, then, you know, it is fantastic. I mean, that's one of the main benefits of having cash or cash-like assets. You know, if there is a big decrease in valuation in most risk assets, that's one that is likely not going to go down, and so you can use that to rebalance without having to sell any depleted assets. Moving on global bonds, this has already taken place. The Brandywine position was exited in meetings with the IAC. The decision was to essentially redeploy that into equities, but it was never reflected in an asset allocation study. Staff was supportive of it. Nikita was supportive of it. In fact, these global bonds introduced a lot of volatility, mostly due to currencies, and it offered very little yield because most developed market securities globally were yielding even negative rates of returns nominally at the time.
And John, one second, Leo. John, has the screen gone blank? My screen is blank in terms of the...
Yes, it has. I'm working on it.
Okay.
Okay. But I can keep on going because there's no table or chart. It's just some language more or less summarizing what's in the slides. And so the recommendation from, it was pretty much unanimous for no matter who we talk was, let's move this into equity. This is what already happened. So the different mixes that we have reviewed with, you know, staff and the IAC all include moving these global bond assets, a 4% allocation that we still have today on paper, to equity. The next section, when you're able to get the slides up, will be on page 100, it's emerging market equities. We do recall the conversation once the asset allocation was established back in 2008, and we were discussing implementation. Ultimately, we all agreed it made sense to do it based upon the riskiness of the asset classes, of the volatility, if you will, and so emerging markets was moved last. And so there hasn't really been any change, and you more or less have had the the assets at the floor level at the time. And so you had a consistent underweight to emerging markets, logically given that you haven't been able yet to move fully from your illiquid positions into the target portfolio. The comment made earlier about having an overweight is correct. And this was discussed at the time by design, realizing that the expectation for returns in emerging markets was greater than in domestic markets for a variety of reasons. And keep in mind, these are projections. So, you know, they could well be wrong or they could be ill-timed, but those were the projections discussed at the time. With respect to this analysis, now the total allocation to equities is expected to increase, but not that of emerging markets. And so on a percentage at the total fund level, even if you were to maintain the same 10% on emerging markets, as the total percent of the equity book, it would decrease in size. So if global equities go from 40 to 50, then emerging markets are 10 out of 50 or 10 out of 60. And so there is a decrease on the percentage weight of emerging markets.
It would be an overweight because the market's 12%, correct?
Correct. So if you were to be, as Ryan mentioned, I think his number was, when you were to look at just the allocation of emerging markets on its own plus the allocation that comes from the global equities, you know, you'd be somewhere around 19%. So it would be about a 50% overweight, taking it from about 12, give or take, to 19. That would be about the positioning. And if you what has been the case is that historically, you know, a mix of stock and bonds used to be enough to meet the liability stream that was coming due. But over the last two decades, interest rates have fallen low enough that, you know, the standard tool, stock and bonds, have not been enough. And that's why you've seen the tremendous rise in alternatives, all the way from hedge funds to real estate, private equity, and the like, because of the premise that those assets would bring higher returns. And in your case, given where you are with your funded status, past experience, liquidity, et cetera, maybe allocating and locking up capital for, you know, 12 or 15 years in private equity might not be ideal. And so maybe shifting some of your weight into emerging market, if that could be an area where perhaps higher returns are expected, could be a consideration. Now, we understand that, you know, there's many ways to go from point A to point B, so this is one option. I think the comment made earlier by Dean is really reasonable. This is a very important decision. There is no rush. It doesn't have to be made today. I think it's really common and prudent to have discussions, and if we need to have multiple iterations, so be it. So from that perspective, we're happy to, you know, discuss options. If the board really wishes to not have this overweight to emerging markets, that would be a little bit lower. Now, I would preface that the Investment Advisory Committee reviewed this and was comfortable with the weight in emerging markets, as was staff and Ida as presented today.
And Lee, I just want to add, we looked at what the expected return would be if we shifted all the EM just into global equity. So we had 60% to global equity and nothing, no dedicated EM. And that would lower the go-forward expected returns by about 25 basis points across the board.
Yeah, which means, on paper there will be a decrease. But, you know, I think we need to bring in humble. These are models. There is a, you know, false degree of precision embedded in this model. But that would be the expectation, yes, that there would be, you know, a bit of a hit to that. I wouldn't call that to be tremendously material, but, you know, it is a consideration, and you bring a good point, Ryan.
I think I would suggest one of the models you maybe look at between now and next month is just show it at market weight at the 12% instead of the 16% to see what the impact, both volatility and return would be. It probably will be 5 basis points or something, but that, I think we should at least know that.
Yeah, okay. We have looked at that. You know, sometimes it's an issue of how many different options we can bring in front of the board, but when we have better guidance, you know, we can focus more on that. As an example, if you're moving into Los Angeles, first you need to focus on the neighborhood. So today maybe we get that from you. This is the neighborhood we want to be at, and then we try to find the right house within that neighborhood at the next meeting or two. So we can certainly do that. And the last item on this section is bonds. The comment was very appropriate with yields being so low. Maybe we need to hold just enough bonds to get the job done, and we don't need to have as much as in the past. And so this has been a common thought. Now, bonds still make sense in our opinion. The question is how much to have when they're yielding maybe 2%. So if you have 30% weight in bonds making 2%, you know, the contribution to return towards your 7% target is 0.6. So it's not a whole lot. So in other words, you're going to rely on equities to make, you need equities to make essentially 9% to get, you know, pretty close to making that 7%. And that means a spread of about 700 basis points. And I think historically, when you look back 100 years, you know, the risk premium for equities has fluctuated between 4 and 6. So it would be tough to assume that over the next 20 years, the risk premium for holding equities will jump to 7% on average and remain there for the duration of the time. And so given that, it makes sense to revisit the bond allocation and, you know, try to get the best out of it. And that tends to be either with cash or with long-duration bonds. With cash, you know, it's very safe, predictable. There is no even impact with respect to changes in interest rates and whatnot, but you make very little. So you have just enough on the short term to meet liabilities that can do. Other groups have used long-duration bonds. You introduce much greater variability, but it tends to be counter-cyclical, especially during drawdowns. But in, you know, in up markets like we've had these past few months, you have double-digit losses on your long-duration bond. So we looked at that as well, felt it was not the best use of your capital at this moment. If you were asking me what page I was on page 101, but not pointing necessarily to any one chart, just talking about it. So with that, that covers, I think, the key points that were raised by the board. And Bill, your point is well taken. We can come back at the next meeting and, you know, report an additional model that has market weight to emerging markets. Section 3 looks at, you know, a quick summary of the last IAC meeting where we went over these. And I think, Aaron, if you're online, you were going to cover this section.
Yeah, thanks, Leo. First, let me pause and see if the board wants to discuss anything yet, or if not, I would highlight maybe four more slides talking about kind of other asset classes we looked at and some risk stress testing. But let me pause first and see if there's any additional comments from the board.
Yeah. No, I guess I would just add my comment is this fund got in trouble by taking above average risk to have an overweight in a high risk, high volatile asset class. I think it'd be more prudent to be down the fairway where we've tried to get the asset allocation for all our asset classes to be more in line with standards that are out there. And I don't think taking a good extra risk for an extra 5 or 6 basis points makes any sense, both from a economic or a public relations standpoint. So I'd be more inclined to, you know, have emerging markets at that 12% than 16. But anybody else have any thoughts? That's my thought.
I actually agree with you, Bill. I mean, overweighting that particular. I mean, let's talk about the risk, right? This is risk reward, and we're over allocating to a riskier asset class. So I agree with you.
I don't think the investment advisory committee would have an issue with that, Bill. By the way, is the screen still not working? Just mine still isn't.
No, it's working now on mine. They're on a slide that says Section 3.
Okay, I'll find it.
Yeah, and Bill and Tina, just to add on the end point. I mean, I think what we need to come back with in June is looking at market weight and what that does to the expected returns going forward, and also what that means for our assumed rate of return. It maybe doesn't move the needle a ton, but I think we already need to have the discussion even based on the EM overweight of 10% or 10% allocation if 7 is achievable, and we're not so sure it is. So I think on the follow-up items, we need to wrap in that assumed rate of return discussion to that in June.
Yeah, and I'd like to hear the alternatives because, I mean, there's two things in play right now, right? We're reducing our reserve. I don't necessarily disagree with that because of what Leo said about the opportunity cost for that, and I get that. So we're reducing that, and we're just putting that to work more vehemently. But where we choose, it's sort of like, well, yes, I agree on the neighborhood, but not maybe necessarily the house in this particular case.
Yeah, and I mean, if we wanted to get back to the same level of go-forward expected return, the only other alternative to look at besides EM equity would be, you know, private, and I don't think there's a desire to or ability to allocate more to private assets at this time. So it's just, do we want something that looks more
and
down the fairway?
Yeah, and that isn't that the, like, natural inflation hedge is, like, real estate? Unfortunately, we don't have great real estate. I mean, I don't know. But I'd like to hear what alternatives that they also considered.
I mean, these numbers are great, but they're not that precise, as Leo pointed out. And if it has a 5 basis point impact but has perception of a lot more risk, we could be right, we could be wrong, and who knows? I mean, people have been saying that about emerging markets for the last several years, and it hasn't worked out. And the other issue in emerging markets, I think you need to address maybe Ryan and Leo, is makeup has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. I mean, it used to be an extraordinarily broad-based index. Now it's a very China-dominated. I think they represent 45% of the emerging markets. So maybe we should at least educate us a little bit about some of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we need to do some education as well just to justify market weight, or we want to take a little bit of an overweight, why we're saying that, and then we'll figure out kind of where we want the ultimate allocation to end up at. But I think it's a combination of looking at a few different options plus the education you're talking about.
Okay, let's move on.
All right, so that's helpful context as we kind of wrap up the comments. So we'll go to 106 next, please. So here are the this part of the process was we broke down all the different common asset classes out there into kind of the functional role they could play in your portfolio and looked at other asset classes. So those are in italics that are not a part of your current or go forward target asset mix. So for a number of reasons, on the next page, 107, many of these possible new asset classes didn't make the cut, given what we would call some DPSP kind of specific constraints. So, you know, for inflation, you know, we don't see the need to add something like commodities, given you already have a lot of energy exposure embedded in the private equity portfolio. You know, we don't see the need for something like infrastructure or private debt because of the sacrifice liquidity. So the only thing that truly kind of made the cut into the next round of evaluation was TIPS, which the IAC didn't really see the merit of rotating out of short-term investment grade bonds into TIPS, really because it just doesn't move the needle much in terms of return and volatility expectations. So if you go to the following page, please, 108. So we've got the current existing target, mix A and mix B, that has been discussed, rotating the same themes, rotating out of global bonds and short-term investment grade bonds into equities. If you look to the gray bars at the bottom, and I'll provide kind of the estimate of what would it look like, Bill, if we had a market EM weight. So you can see over the 20-year kind of forward-looking projection, as you obviously increase your equity exposure, your return expectation is increasing, simply rotating out of bonds into equities. If you were to reduce EM and add it further to global equity, I would argue that you might see, Ryan threw out the 20 basis point number, but, you know, somewhere, so you might see between 10 and 20 basis points lower. So you might see a 6.6 instead of a 6.8. You might see for mix B something around 6.8. Risk, though, would also decrease. So that's expected standard deviation as we would go down a little bit. So let's go all the way to page 113 and what this translates into in terms of probabilities. So if you think of the classic normal distribution bell curve, if you have a mix that models out to exactly a 7.0% return expectation, you end up with a basically 50-50 chance that you'll be below that number or above that number. So any of these mixes that model out to projections of, you know, 6.5, 6.6, 6.7, they're to the left on that bar chart, which reduces the probability that you'll be over 7.0 over the 20 years. The 10-year numbers are lower as well, given kind of the assumptions that we have in most of the industry that the next 10 years you might have lower returns because they're more impacted by current valuations and current yields. So,
114, Aaron.
Sure.
Show the chart.
Yeah, so you see that bottom line. So the flip side of all this is there are risks, obviously, if you maximize your probability of reaching these, of going into riskier assets, naturally you have higher, or you're more exposed to big market corrections, no surprise. So 117 will end here. Go to 117, please. So we can quantify some of this where we stress test. The top three lines are bond market stress events, and the bottom three are equity market stress events. So you can see where you are with the current target. If you have, if you're looking at the third line, a drastic rising rate environment, as you go from the current to mix A to mix B, as you trade from bond exposure to equity exposure, the benefit is you're now less exposed to bond market events. However, you know, the natural trade-off is go to the bottom of the table. The more equity exposure you have, the more equity risk you have. But frankly, you could make the argument that if you're down 25% or down 29%, it's not that big of a, you're in a rough position either way. So I would argue it doesn't really move the needle significantly. To be down, you know, only 25 versus only 29. If we were going to look at this with EM, those numbers might be EM reduced. Those numbers would be a little less dire, but they'd still be in that same magnitude. Finally, 118, it's important to remember that we're just trading liquid assets for other liquid assets. So none of these mixes have a different liquidity profile than your current target. Now, this is not talking about your actual exposure, but if you get to your target mix or you get to one of these newer mixes, it's still the same liquidity profile and still much more liquid than where you are today.
Great.
So, yeah, so we have some homework to do, but go ahead, Bill.
I was going to say, just add for next month the mix being what we just talked about with the EM being at a market weighting, just so we can see it. I still think it's I once had a legal advisor tell me that a board never make important decisions the day they presented the information. They should have a chance to think about it, look at it, and I think now the overall asset allocation, do that again. But does anybody else have any other inputs they would like to see, or any other sensitivities or any other asset allocation things they think we should look at other than the ones we've talked about?
Hey, Bill, this is Gilbert. I just want to add another comment, if I could, which is most of the discussion at the IAC related to how much to take down the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think there'd be any issues with the IAC. As it relates to the reserve, the whole point there was if you're going to make a change, you need to do enough of a change to move the needle or there's no reason to do anything. So that's where we landed on that amount.
That's prudent. I think it's prudent. Even if we agreed, I would just wait a month to approve it, but I agree that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, I just want to give more color to everybody.
Thanks, Gilbert. If we can go to 63, I just want to talk about the safe reserve reduction and how we got comfortable with that for a minute, and then we'll get any additional input and then see if we want to talk about implementation or hold off till next month. But 63, John. And this addresses your question from earlier, Tina.
What page are you looking on again?
What page? 63, John. Sorry, not 53. All right, so how did I get comfortable with the recommendation to reduce safety reserve from 30 months or 2.5 years down to 18 months, year and a half? I want to look at what has changed since we put this in place 3 years ago. We've covered a little bit of this, but our allocation to private markets was 50% at the time when we put the safety reserve in place. We're down to 30% now, so we have more liquidity within the plan. Another key factor for me is that 4% allocation to investment-grade bonds managed by Longfellow was not part of the allocation when we put the safety reserve in place. So this is a really safe portfolio and another potential source of rebalancing, and I look at it as the reserve tank on the safety reserve. So if we entered a prolonged market downturn and we bled through the safety reserve, this is the next place we start drawing assets out of. And then the yield on the short-term investment-grade bond portfolio was 2.8% back in 2018, and it's 200 basis points lower now at under 1%. So the return trade-off and return drag is a little bit higher with lower expected returns from that portfolio. And also at the lower safety reserve level, we currently have language in the IPS that we're going to look at the safety reserve on both the 9% allocation and the total amount of dollars required for 18 months of benefit outflow. So I would look at it at 9% right now at current asset levels would be higher than the 18 months, and I'd want to hold the 9% allocation until such time where 18 months, if we started seeing the net benefit gap increase from 9 to 10 million, we might adjust the amount we're holding in that safety reserve upward based on that, given the lower level overall.
You know, Ryan.
Ryan, this is Michael Browning.
Go on. I'll talk after.
I was just going to say, I think it's important for the rest of the committee to understand that the reduction in the safety reserve happens over time, and it's not a kind of a quick reduction, and that, mm-hmm. It can be evaluated along the way. I think during the investment committee meeting, we had that discussion about the time to implement. So I just want to, mm-hmm. I want to kind of reiterate that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're continually evaluating the safety reserve and what's needed and what we're seeing on benefit outflows at point one. On the timing, we could literally do it next week if we wanted to. If we just paid benefits out of the safe reserve for a year at the current cash outflow rate, it would take about a year to get from 15 down to 9. What we're talking about doing is trying to get down from that 15 to the 9% target by the end of the year. So that would be a combination of paying benefit outflows from it with about $50 million of money drawn from the safe reserve to reallocate into the liquid asset classes. So a combination of benefit payments and outflows would get us there. And if we look at 66.
And just one more, I'd just like to say one thing. It also talks about what Gilbert was saying, that if you were going to do anything, it had to be meaningful. And I think this is probably an appropriate place to look at. But I still don't understand why we would have to ease into it. Why wouldn't we do it immediately?
Okay. I think it's just a combination of comfort on doing it over time, and we, instead of putting $120 into the market tomorrow, we would pace it out over the remainder of the year in addition to the private market distributions we have coming back. And I would like to target a 3% reduction by the end of Q3 and then another 3% by the end of the year. I don't think there's any right or wrong answer on how quickly you do it. It's just I want to have a plan, and doing it that way, we're not reinvesting that much money immediately into the liquid portfolio, and then we could do it on an even quarterly basis and pair the amounts that we're reinvesting with the private market distributions coming back.
Okay, and why don't you just give some thought to what Tina said, and then get mm-hmm. Gil's input as well. And then as we come back next month, we can have a definitive plan that we would adopt as part of the overall approval of the asset allocation.
Mm-hmm. And what really moved the needle on money going back into the liquid portfolio with the safe reserve reduction is, as we're reducing it, we can reinvest all of the money coming back from private markets into the liquid portfolio, so we're not needing to hold money back. So if you look at this, we're actually expecting about $75 million coming back through end of the year, so there'd be more money going into equities and EM debt from distributions than from pulling money out of the safety reserve.
Okay, are we pretty close to wrapping up this part?
Yeah, I think we got the feedback we need. It's looking at a few additional options, doing some EM education next month, talking about what that means for the projected rate of return, and then finalizing what we want the implementation to look like.
And I would just encourage the rest of the board members, if you get a chance to go through this material at your leisure a little bit more and you come up with any other suggestions or ideas, maybe run them through Kelly and just, we can do other modeling or whatever if people feel that they need to, but I want you to have time to be thoughtful about it. Okay.
Joe, is there any desire to look at any options that have a higher allocation to private markets, or does the board want to keep all the options we're looking at the 15% level with 5% to real estate, 5% to private equity, and 5% to ag?
I mean, I think for the time being, until we get down to those levels, I'm comfortable keeping them what you suggested. But, as we get closer to liquidating the legacy portfolios, we can take a relook at it.
Okay.
I think longer term, you probably will have slightly higher allocations. I just don't think over the next 2 or 3 years we'll be ready to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's understandable. Just checking.
Okay, Kelly, do you want to give the executive director's report?
Yes, thank you. Bill, to answer your question from earlier, the cost of Texpers, Ken was right. The actual registration is pretty low, $25 or $50, depending on the conference. But we budget $1,000 per conference just on average, which covers airfare, hotel, food, and, transportation from the airport, those types of things. So it's roughly $1,000 when, with all-in costs, depending on the location of the conference. So that's the answer to that question. The association newsletters are there for your information. As far as open records requests go, we received 4 since the last board meeting. They've all been closed. As far as office reopening goes, I have looked at what the city's doing, which they're not sure really what they're doing as far as in-person council meetings. And at this point, they're kind of phasing staff in. The staff recommended that in-person council meetings start in August, but the city hasn't made a decision on that yet. ERF is not going back until August or September. So what I am intending to do, unless the board has a problem with this, is continuing what we're doing now, which is basically staff is going in to the office as they need to go in. Investments will, I mean, we always have a receptionist there. We always have someone to cover the receptionist break. We have a person in there scanning. John Holt's been going in consistently, and investments is going to start going in 3 days a week, and then other staff members can go in as needed. So, for example, yesterday we had 9 of 24 employees in the office, so more than a third of the employees were in the office yesterday. And I think I want to continue that through the summer, just recognizing everybody's kind of in a different situation with what they need to do in the office and what their kids are doing and that type of thing. And then starting September, have a more formal schedule of, okay, this is what it looks like. So I have more of an expectation of who's in the office when. Did someone have a question? Okay. The other thing that we have done or will be doing at the end of this month, it got moved, our first in-person recruit class for the police department. So we're doing that. They gave us an option of doing virtual or in-person, and the staff member that does that training class elected to do it in-person, so they're going to do that. As far as the CIO recruitment goes, the brochure is basically the draft of the brochure is done. I need to send that to the members of the IAC and Makita to get any comments they have, and then we'll be posting in that in PNI and the CFA Association and anywhere else any of you think that needs to go. So that's pretty much ready to go. And I'll probably keep it open for about a month. But as we get resumes in, you know, just start reviewing them once we start receiving those. The GFOA Award, that's the Government Finance Officers Award for Excellence in Financial Reporting. We received that award for the 2019 Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, so I'd like to recognize the team that works on that because it really is a team effort, and that's the accounting staff, Brenda and her group. John Holt has a huge part in that. Investments has a big section in that as well, and Melissa does all of the layout and that type of thing. So she's a big part in that as well. So I'd like to thank them for all their work on that. I think that's it, unless anyone has any questions.
Just applaud and recognize the team for a great job. And if we were in person, we would be clapping.
Well, thank you. Bill, did you want to do the closed session items before Hancock just because of time at this point?
Yes. I was going to mention we're going to lose a trustee or two in about a half hour or so. So what we're going to do is go into closed session now. We expect that to be approximately 30 minutes. Then we'll come back into open session and have the Hancock presentation, which is our last agenda item before going to the supplemental meeting where we really have nothing additional. So if people want to hang on for a half hour and come back for the last item, great. If not, we understand. So let's go to closed session now.